All rise.
The court is reconvened. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, before we begin, someone has sent me a note that we have students here from a Poli Sci undergraduate course about the judiciary. If that's the case, would they please stand? Oh, very nice. Very nice. You may be seated. Did you all receive the materials for court with class before you came? You did. Okay, very good. Well, we're glad to have you with us, and I hope you had a chance to hear Justice Rebecca Bradley, who spoke with some of the students over the lunch hour. Maybe not, because you're coming in the afternoon. But with that little bit of preliminary information out of the way, I will call our last case for today, Winnebago County versus JM. Are you prepared to begin? Please begin.
May it please the court, Assistant State Public Defender Colleen Ball appearing on behalf of the petitioner, J.M. 41 years ago, this court established the constitutional right to adversary counsel in Chapter 51 commitment proceedings. But in all those years, it has never addressed a claim for ineffective assistance of counsel or established a legal standard by which such a claim should be measured. The county urges this court to adopt the Strickland test for ineffective assistance of counsel that, of course, was developed for criminal cases. The JM and the AMICUS, the National Disability Rights Network, asked this court to modify Strickland's prejudice test for Chapter 51 cases. We propose different modifications, but either one is acceptable to JM.
Has any jurisdiction in the United States adopted the proposal that you were making or the disability rights amicus?
Not that I am aware of, Your Honor. I will address JM's claim for ineffective assistance of counsel first, and then I will turn to the claim for a new trial in the interest of justice.
Why don't you tell us the difference between the two tests?
Well, maybe we should start with the test, the well-known test. The Strickland test is, but for counsel's unprofessional performance, is there a reasonable probability of a different outcome? That's one end of the spectrum. And on the other end of the spectrum is the National Disability Rights Network's test, which is once the respondent in a Chapter 51 proceeding establishes a deficient performance, then you presume prejudice, the court would presume it. And JM is in the middle, and JM would contend that once you establish deficient performance, that would create a rebuttable presumption of prejudice. So I guess to set the stage for this discussion, I'd like the court to know, what led up to what we're looking at here today. JM landed in jail for failure to pay child support, and he was pretty upset about it. He acted out, and because of that, he was charged with battery. Then he was diagnosed with schizophrenia, and that upset him even more because he had never had a diagnosis before he went into the prison system. And so then he gets in the prison system, and then the next thing he knows, he is diagnosed, as I said, and he is committed and then forcibly medicated. All right, and the county sought to extend his commitment under a provision that would require the jury to find that he was dangerous. And so on the first day of trial here, we know it is undisputed that defense counsel did not want her client to appear dangerous in front of the jury. In fact, what she said to the court right at the beginning of trial is she saw JM wearing shackles, and she said, I don't want that. That's just like saying this fella is dangerous. And she said, court, I asked WRC many times not to have him appear in shackles, and I have not heard any resolve about that. That's a quote. The court didn't hold a security hearing. It just let DOC officers put the stun belt on underneath JM's pant legs. Well, the post-conviction motion then asserts that counsel also asked WRC to provide civilian clothes for JM to wear at trial. And that request, likewise, was not resolved by the time of trial. Counsel made no record of what had happened with that request, and she didn't object, and she didn't request a curative instruction.
Counsel, you know, there is another section under which all of this matter could have proceeded. The county proceeded under 5121A, but if they had been under 5121AR, they would have had to have acknowledged the fact that he was a prisoner. Would it be your contention that even if the proceedings were under 5121AR, where that acknowledgement and the length of the sentence must be made, that still he should not appear in prison clothes, and that would be harmful to him?
No, absolutely, he should not have appeared in prison clothes.
Under either section?
Under either section.
Okay.
And the reason, Chief Justice, is because we have that case out of the Seventh Circuit called Mouse v. Baker,
yep,
where the Seventh Circuit says, hey, you know what, it's one thing to say, tell someone that you're a prisoner, you know, or the client's a prisoner. It's entirely different to brand them as a prisoner, as dangerous, during the entire course of the trial.
Well, do you think that he would be branded as being dangerous just because he's in prison garb if you had to tell the jury that he was?
Well, that was the whole point of that case, Your Honor. That is exactly the point. It was a civil case, and they're saying, look, you're giving them a constant visual reminder, hearkening back to Estelle V. Williams.
That's a lot stronger than simply saying it.
Yes.
Okay,
right.
Thank you.
That's my position, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
So, as I said, we had the post-conviction motion. It makes the required allegations that counsel didn't make a record, she didn't request a curative instruction, et cetera. She didn't object to the fact that there were two DOC officers accompanying JM. In fact, she herself suggested that a DOC officer stand right behind him, kind of like a human shackle, as he testified. Okay? So if we turn to JM's ineffective assistance of counsel claim, the relief we seek on that is a Mockner hearing. And I think three cases get us there. The first one is Estelle V. Williams, because that holds that the government cannot compel a defendant in a criminal trial to be tried in prison clothes, because that undermines the presumption of innocence and violates his right to due process. We also have a Wisconsin Attorney General opinion, which is not a case, but it is persuasive authority, which says that Estelle's principles apply to Chapter 51 cases, and the reason is that dangerousness is an issue. That's an issue for the jury to decide. But very importantly, we also have a Wisconsin Court of Appeals case called State v. Champlain, and there the court held that that it was ineffective assistance of counsel for the lawyer not to object to the fact that her client was wearing a visible security restraint on his arm during the course of trial. And our argument is basically Champlain's principles apply here, right? Counsel asked WRC for civilian clothes. She performed efficiently by not resolving the issue before trial, by not making a record, by not objecting, by not requesting a jury instruction. We don't know why she didn't do those things, and for that reason, there should be a Mockner hearing.
Counsel, does the success of your case depend on us accepting the proposed modification to Strickland?
No, it does not.
Okay.
Would you like me to address that now, or will we get farther down?
Okay. Yeah.
Your Honor, my position on prejudice is that JM should win under any of the three standards. And the reason is that what happened in this case is pretty close to structural error. Okay? Once the jury saw JM branded as dangerous, between his uniform and the guards, the verdict was a fait accompli. At that point, it didn't really matter what anybody was going to testify. They had that image stuck in their mind. So I would argue that under any three tests, he should win. Nevertheless, I do think this is an important opportunity for the court, because this is the first time the court will be deciding whether Strickland applies to a 51 case. So if one way to decide the case is say, great, JM wins, you're right. You know, that's pretty much like structural error. But, you know, Do we want to wait another 41 years for another ineffective assistance of counsel case in a Chapter 51 to make it up here? I hope the court will address what the proper standard is.
Does it matter that it's a statutory right to counsel?
Well, Your Honor, actually, I think it was Memel, the case from the 70s, that said that actually we have a, or no, I wanted to back that out. It might be Lessard versus Schmidt and then getting repeated by Memel, that says it's a constitutional right to adversary counsel. But you're right, it is embodied in our statute. It's not a Sixth Amendment right to counsel, if that's where you were going, Your Honor.
Right. Does it make a difference?
Does it make a difference? Well, in this sense, Strickland was definitely designed for the Sixth Amendment counsel situation.
That's why I asked.
Right. And here, the constitutional right is based on due process on the 14th Amendment. But admittedly, the courts around the country are, they have this knee-jerk reaction. They will acknowledge that it's the 14th Amendment that provides the right to counsel, but as soon as you hear the words ineffective assistance of counsel, they say Strickland. So that's how we've gotten in this position, I guess, where we are today. So I think, summing up on deficient performance, that J.M.'s post-conviction lawyer made all the necessary allegations to get to a Mockner hearing on that point. So the real debate then would be over prejudice. And as I said before, there's three proposed tests before the court. And as I have also argued, I believe that my client should win under any three of those tests, given, and I'm resting this mostly on Estelle and on the Court of Appeals opinion in Champlain, just the impact that something like a security device, a visible security device, or a prison uniform has on the jury. That's why we're much closer to the structural error end of
why do you request a rebuttable presumption or presumed vis-a-vis the prejudice prong? If you would prevail on a straight, if you will, application of prejudice, and if this court finds prejudice, then this case for the next 41 years will serve as precedent that under these facts, this is both deficient performance and prejudice.
I think that, Your Honor, that would be okay for these facts. But these facts are going to be very rare. It is rare, I think, for a county to proceed, as Chief Justice Rogensack sort of hinted at the beginning with her question. It's rare for them to proceed under 5121, which is the name, the main Chapter 51 provision for people who live in the community, civilians, non-inmates, right? So it's going to be pretty rare you're going to have a case where a person is going to be in a prison uniform if they are being committed under that provision. Okay? So that's a little bit unusual. But I think it's very important to address it, you know, to decide which one of these prejudice tests you want, precisely as I said, because these cases get up here so rarely. And Justice Bradley, I would suggest to you that the more common kinds of ineffective assistance of counsel that we see as we're reviewing Chapter 51 cases, those would be things like failure to investigate, or they might be failure to object to hearsay. And it's pretty hard to overcome that, right, and prove a reasonable probability of a different outcome if your opponent, the county, has at least one psychiatrist who's going to testify that your client is mentally ill, dangerous, and a proper subject for treatment. So that's the reason to be concerned here. I've noticed in, as I mentioned about cases around the country, but I've also noticed looking at cases from our court that, you know, ineffective assistance of counsel, Strickland. But Strickland, importantly itself, does not say that that's the only game in town, right? That court was looking at a variety of different prejudice tests, and it chose one that it thought balanced the reliability and finality concerns in a criminal case Well, but it specifically said that, courts could adopt a different test. And so what I would like to do is sort of walk through, let's compare the reliability and finality concerns in a 51 versus a criminal case.
I would like you to do that, too, but before you do that.
Okay.
Your response to my question sounded to me like, well, you know, what if we find ineffective assistance of counsel in circumstances for failure to investigate was the example that you gave.
Right.
Yet the question that you have presented to this court is a narrower question. You've asked the court whether trial counsel's failure to object to, prevent the admission of, or request a curative instruction to address evidence of the client's prisoner status.
That is true.
That's what you're, I mean.
That is my question, and the only reason we're talking about what's the proper standard is because this court hasn't set the standard. We sort of needed to know the standard in order to apply it.
I mean, as I understand it, your opposing counsel acknowledges that inherent in the concept of the right to counsel is a right to effective counsel. So that's first base, right?
Right.
And your issue is vis-a-vis someone in a evidence of a client's prisoner's status. I return to my question, and that is, if this case answered your issue, if there is evidence of prisoner status in this case, hypothetically, who knows what we're going to do, and that it was not only deficient performance, that it was precedent, that it was prejudicial, that precedent stands. So why do you need presumptions? I guess you need presumptions, whether they're rebuttable or presumptive and not rebuttable, to have the wider category of ineffective assistance of counsel?
No, let me explain, Your Honor. I guess this is my concern. It would be great if the court ruled in favor of my client on the first issue and simply said, yep, there's prejudice. But so many times we have seen that no one ever questions the Strickland standard in these cases where it's never applied before because it was designed for, that if I said nothing, the court would do that here too. And I wanted the court to be mindful of the fact that there are very good arguments for not just adopting Strickland wholesale.
Okay.
That's
fair enough. Thank
that
you.
Is what I was doing. Given that this is a law development court, and it would be very easy, as it happened, honestly, in the MDS case regarding termination of parental rights proceedings, no one said boo about, geez, does Strickland actually fit? I don't know whether it does in TPRs. That decision might be great, but once you start working in 51s, you realize it doesn't fit here.
Well, what doesn't fit? There are two parts of Strickland. One, whether the performance of the attorney is below grade. It's not quite the way it says it, but below what is a reasonable attorney. The second part of Strickland is prejudice.
Correct.
Right? So what is it that you want different in this 5120?
Just
want
the prejudice prong, Your Honor.
The
deficient
part.
Performance prong seems it's a well-known test, and it would seem pretty logical to require someone proceeding under Chapter 51, if they have a complaint about their lawyer, that they have to prove that the person's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. We don't have a problem with that, and neither does the amicus, I'd like to point out. The problem comes in with the prejudice test. And I wanted to mention, let's just pause for a second and think about how are criminal cases different than 51s. Well, Strickland says you need to think about finality in criminal proceedings, and you need to really worry about reliability of criminal proceedings. So let's start with finality, right? Unlike a criminal case, Chapter 51s can be extended. You have the first one, it lasts only 6 months, and then thereafter the county has to reprove grounds for the commitment every year. So those cases aren't final in the way that a criminal case is.
And why is that significant? I mean, I recognize that Strickland said that finality played a role in its decision and the standard that it created. but it only gave that one sentence. Why does finality bear on whether the person complaining about their counsel needs to show prejudice?
Well, in Strickland, the reason that they want finality is they want to minimize the collateral attacks, right? So they're trying to keep the conviction final and reduce litigation, right? Constant litigation. My point on finality is you could have the highest prejudice test in the world, and it's still not going to be final. There's going to be very likely an extension year after year after year, unless, of course, that the person who's been committed gets better and can somehow manage himself out in the community. But you know, a lot of these cases are committed multiple times. So I'm talking about finality in the sense of you're not going to gain an advantage in reduction of litigation by having a high prejudice test.
Right. So in commitment proceedings, because those can occur quite frequently, shouldn't we be interested in increasing the standard to be able to collaterally attack those judgments? Because there's going to be another opportunity to file another petition pretty soon anyway.
I think that actually plays to the to the opposite point.
And you mentioned that in your brief. So why is that?
Well, so this is how it would work, Your Honor. Somebody's committed on day one, and he says, I've got an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. He files his notice of intent. It's 60 days to get the transcripts. It's X number of days to file the motion. Then you have the hearing. Well, you're basically now just months away from the next extension, okay? And if you find ineffective assistance of counsel and you say, we're throwing this case out, what burden does that put on the county? Well, you can see by looking in the appendix to my brief what a petition for commitment looks like. It's nothing. It's just pro forma. It just means the next day they're going to have to file a new petition, right? On the other hand, let's think about the individual. Let's, instead of sort of assuming here that everything went right, let's assume, what if somebody was wrongfully committed? Because that actually happens. Here's what you've got to worry about. There are very significant constitutional rights at stake. It's not just the stigma of mental illness that the person is suffering, but in addition to that, obviously this massive curtailment of liberty, a term we frequently use in United States Supreme Court precedent. But in addition, we often, these commitments often go hand in hand with medication and involuntary treatment, and that starts to affect your behavior, your mind. Those are very significant substantive due process rights. Now,
do your arguments apply equally to commitments for outpatient treatment? Because we have both kinds of commitments. Your client's inpatient, but we have had people committed, and they're committed to outpatient treatment.
Which argument, Your Honor?
The argument that you're making about why
the finality.
Yes.
Okay.
Exactly.
Right. Mm-hmm. So to the extent it has to be re-upped, yes, I agree. The reason I think we need to be concerned about reliability with these commitments.
Well, Ms. Ball, I don't think anyone would argue the con on being concerned about reliability, but my question would be, wouldn't the procedural safeguard permitted in Strickland, that is the prejudice test, provide just that, a safeguard against the parade of horribles you were listing in response to Justice Kelly's question about someone wrongly committed, and then you raised the specter of administered medication? Isn't that what the Strickland application of the Strickland test would permit a reviewing court to do, to say, well, was there a deficient performance, but did it matter?
No, Your Honor, I think that what the problem is with the high Strickland test is it actually prevents that, the court, from ever getting at the question of ineffective assistance of counsel. It's so high that what the county can do is say, I already had one.
The first question of Strickland was there deficient performance?
Oh, for sure, Your Honor, but of course we can decide an ineffective assistance of counsel claim on either deficient performance or on prejudice. Right, a court does not have to address both, and if it's really easy to address prejudice, that's what's going to happen. And you see that. I mean, the argument that the county is making here is exactly the kind of argument that I'm talking about.
I don't follow. I mean, of course, if there's no deficient performance, the court would never reach prejudice. Is that what you mean?
No. What I'm arguing is that...
I didn't understand where you said the court could address it just by answering one of those questions. I don't understand.
Well, a claim for ineffective assistance of counsel can be disposed of either for lack of prejudice or for failure to show deficient performance. And courts often dispose of them for just saying...
Right, but you said it in reverse order, and you go to deficient performance first.
A court does not have to, but...
Right, but in order to find ineffective assistance, I think Justice Gableman's saying you need both prongs.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. About those differences between criminal and civil cases, on reliability, keep in mind that these cases proceed on very, very compressed schedules. So from the day that a person is detained, it only takes 14 days to get to the trial, and the defense lawyer gets the psychiatrist reports just 48 hours before that trial. Assuming that defense counsel has other cases, particularly other fast-track cases, there is little chance that he or she is going to be able to put the same amount of investigation and trial prep into that kind of a case that you would, for example, for a criminal case. In addition, you have the fact that a criminal case, it's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, it's a unanimous verdict. In a civil commitment, it's a 5-6 verdict, it's clear and convincing evidence. So once again, we're having less confidence in the outcome of a civil commitment proceeding. And then, very importantly, consider the elements and how the elements differ between these two cases. In a criminal case, you're looking at asking the jury to find beyond a reasonable doubt, did defendant do A, B, C, D? And in a civil commitment case, you're asking the jury to essentially assess risk. You're looking at dangerousness, and we know that is very hard to do. It's so hard to do that, as the amicus points out, even trained psychiatrists aren't very good at that. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is James Carney. I am a solo practitioner in Neenah. For the last 28 years, I have had the pleasure of being contracting with Winnebago County to be their assistant corporation counsel. And in that capacity, I do handle all of the Chapter 51 proceedings in Winnebago County. In Winnebago County, as you know, we have a number of facilities. Besides the Winnebago Mental Health Institute, we're honored to have the Wisconsin Resource Center, which is actually the receiving center for all inmates in the state of Wisconsin that have mental health issues. So you are looking at the attorney that's handled those matters for the last 28 years. In addition, we have a couple of hospitals as well that handle, that have behavioral health units. We also use other facilities outside of Winnebago County. So Winnebago County, for good or bad, handles quite a number of mental commitment proceedings on an annual basis. In my capacity as Assistant Corporation Counsel for Winnebago County, as has been mentioned, the statutes provide for counsel, and I certainly would agree that that would have little meaning at all if that did not mean effective assistance of counsel. So I totally concur with the premise that at least under the due process clause of the United States Constitution, as well as Wisconsin, that that has to mean effective assistance of counsel.
Let's just say I agree with opposing counsel. And I think all you have to do is show deficient performance and that in this case it was deficient. What happens next? Is he released? Is he sent back for another hearing? What, in your view, would happen if opposing counsel's argument prevailed?
If that determination is made at the Court of Appeals or at your level, I suspect the individual I would suspect you would send it back for a rehearing. That would be what I would hope would happen, because I would want someone who has got a mental health issue to
was confined in a prison before he went to get mental health treatment, correct? And I don't know that I recall reading what his prison sentence looks like, because one would think, and I may be wrong, so please correct me, that if he's confined for mental health, his prison sentence keeps being chipped away too, that you don't wait to start the prison until you're out of mental health. So if in fact his time in prison for the difficulties he got into because he got angry about child support and apparently got into some physical interactions because of that, if that time had run and now all we have holding him is the commitment proceedings, if I agree with opposing counsel, don't we have to just say he's released?
If he has been discharged from prison, he would have...
Well, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you. I don't maybe understand exactly how the two fit together as well as I'd like to. If he's committed and his prison sentence runs out, is he discharged from prison and there's some kind of a formal document, even though he may still be kept in a mental health facility?
He is discharged from prison.
Okay.
The Wisconsin Resource Center, Your Honor, is an outpatient facility. It's not an inpatient facility.
Okay, so all right.
He's discharged from prison, and generally my procedure, and it would depend on what statute they're committed under, so now I have to be clear. If it's under 5120, sub 1, sub A, in my opinion, and... I guess it's my opinion that counts, but I can tell you there's disagreements throughout the state, but I'm the attorney that handles this matter, so it's my opinion.
What you would be recommending?
On a 1A, we typically will transfer venue to the county of residence.
Okay.
And that outpatient commitment would continue in that county.
Okay. So
they are released from prison, go to their county. They are on an outpatient basis. And that could look like a lot of different things. That could look like a CBRF. Mm-hmm. That could look like you get to go home and stay with your mom.
Mm-hmm.
That could look like you just get to be on the streets.
Yeah, you can't really tell then.
Here's a different hypothetical. Like,
you can't really tell then if we would agree with that argument, what would happen next. There's no real firm next step.
My point is if it is a commitment under the 1AR, which has been mentioned here,
this
was not a 1AR.
This is
a 1A, and I want to clarify that it's not true, because I do them, that I do more ARs than 1ARs than 1As. In fact, I prefer, if I have a dangerousness element, I'm going to use 1A every day. Okay?
Because you want that specifically addressed.
Yep. I don't care if it's an inmate and there's a dangerous element, it's going to be a commitment under 1A. The only time I use AR is if, in fact, they're not dangerous, but they have a mental health issue that needs attending to. And we may hear more about AR in the future, but another reason to use 1A is who knows where AR is going to be in the future. But, again, so I hope I answered your question.
Yeah, no, you did. I just wasn't clear on how the two parts of our system really affects someone in the position of JM. So you were very helpful. Thank you.
So I don't ever consider these to be punitive. I'm always working from the angle that I want to help them resolve their issues. Obviously, if they have mental health issues, that's their symptoms typically are interfering with their functioning, whether they're in the community or in the prison setting. And let's be clear, too, as you decide this issue, it's not limited to people that we are committing who are in the prison system. So you might want to keep that in mind, that any decision you may make on this rule will be applicable not only to inmates, which this case happens to be, but also people who are not inmates.
So as I understand your argument, you are not arguing that we adopt the Montana current rule that Strickland does not apply.
Actually, Montana reversed their decision on August 30th.
Okay.
So I would be asking that you adopt the Montana.
Okay. Okay. So you're asking us to apply Strickland.
I'm asking, you know, to be perfectly honest, Judge Ziegler, I don't think it's that important an issue. There are other methods within Chapter 51 that is going to get an inmate or someone who's not an inmate back into court with a new trial much quicker than anything we're going to do through the appellate system. So a properly advised subject who's been committed is never going to follow through with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim.
But then what do you want this court to do? What do you want this court to do? Why are we here?
Well, I'm kind of an involuntary person here.
I know. You're involuntarily committed to this court.
You're asking us to apply the two-pronged test,
right? I think that the Strickland test is a solid test.
Deficient performance and
deficient
prejudice.
Performance with
if
prejudice.
You don't have both prongs, then you don't have a violation.
Again, that's my opinion. Do I think we're going to drastically change things if we modify that? I don't. But I think it's a solid test. There's a good body of law that follows it. Let's face it. If this law had done some research, we had, I think she found, 5 cases in which there's been an ineffective assistance of counsel claim since we've enacted the law in 75. That's barely 1 a decade, and probably more of them are more recent than later. But this is affecting less than 0.1% of people who apparently feel they have that claim. That coupled with the body of law that we have under Strickland and the cases that have flowed from that, I think that is more than sufficient to be capable of handling what JM has asked to be handled. My point is that if someone feels that these cases are never final, okay. So as far as finality, in a Chapter 51 proceeding, they're never final. Under 5120, sub 16, Wisconsin, by statute, has permitted and is allowing anyone who feels that they want to have their case reevaluated to be reevaluated. They can make that request any time after 30 days of their commitment or the extension of their commitment. Between the 30 days and the 120-day period, it's discretionary with the circuit court whether they're going to grant them another hearing. After the 120-day period, it's automatic. They get all of the same rights they had at the initial proceeding. So my point is, why wait for an appellate court to decide if your counsel's been ineffective? Because your current counsel should be telling you, just apply for a new hearing. They're going to get all of the same rights. They're going to get a jury trial. They're going to get a counsel. They're going to get 2 new independent evaluations. And I'm going to have to prove the level of clear and convincing proof again that they met the criteria.
Counsel, let's say there was prejudice. You were previously asked about what happens then, and your response was, I would hope that it would be sent back for a rehearing. At least based on practice years ago in the county in which I served as a circuit court judge, it could be the situation that the person is just sent back to jail, likely, and then proceedings are initiated again. Is that just as likely as a rehearing ordered from this court on remand? And that's what I assume would happen.
If it's an inmate, obviously they would continue to be in the prison system.
That's right. And then someone would start the Chapter 51 and would just start all over again.
Somebody is me, because they're going to go back to the Wisconsin Resource Center, and I don't commence them myself. Of course, it's the psychiatrists and the psychologists that are requesting that we do these things. But that would likely just be recommenced. If it was dismissed, it could be again started as a 1AR, assuming we still have that available in our toolbox. And if it's a 1A, again, if it's an inmate, they're going to go back to prison. If they're someone who is not in prison, which of course the request here could affect them, that have a little more uncertainty. But I would hope that we're not necessarily just suggesting that the matter is dismissed with prejudice and, you know, the individual is released, because I think that certainly would not be in the best interest or public policy probably for those individuals.
Counsel, in response to a question from the Chief Justice, Ms. Ball responded by discussing the difference that's been recognized under law between telling a jury that a potential committee is an inmate at a penal institution versus the inmate being dressed in prison garb. I wonder if you would address that.
I would be happy to. I have done in the course of my career probably somewhere between 50 and 100 jury trials. I don't count them, so that's why I'm giving you a pretty big range. It's at least 50. All but two of them have been inmates. So my significant jury trial caseload anyway is the individuals that are in the prison system. Of those jury trials, I would say that probably more than half of them have appeared in the prison. I would like to say that I have 100% success rate, just because I think that was important to the individuals I was attempting to commit. But there have been three jury trials in which the jury found that the individual did not meet the criteria. My recollection is, and one of them I had actually this year, so I'm certain of that, but the other two, and all three of them, I believe, wore their prison garb. I would suggest that to make any type of a finding that simply wearing prison garb to a mental commitment proceeding was prejudicial, I would totally disagree with that. If I was back in private practice, and I can tell you this from my experience, I think probably the best defense would be to bring them into court with their prison garb and argue that they're already confined and they don't need to be committed.
But the prison garb itself, doesn't that convey some information to the fact finder?
I'm sorry, Judge.
Just the fact that the person is wearing prison garb, that conveys certain information to the fact finder, yes?
It does.
Okay. And that information is that this is a person worthy of being locked up.
It's a person who is already locked up for some other reason.
Right. And presumably, if we put full faith and credit in our legal system, we conclude from that, and any reasonable juror would conclude from that he's worthy of being locked up.
Frankly, as the Assistant Corporation Counsel Judge, I'd prefer they be in civilian clothing. I've never objected to it. It's actually nothing in this record that suggests that JM objected to it. So, I mean, we should be clear about that. There's not a thing in this record other than the post-conviction motion brought by an appellate attorney that was arguing about that.
Right, that's part of the ineffective assistance of counsel thing, right? Well, maybe somebody should have been objecting.
Well, and it may have been JM's decision that he wanted to appear in his prison garb.
Well, in a criminal case, you wouldn't want someone appearing in prison garb because you wouldn't want the jury to conclude that they've necessarily even ever been convicted of anything, nor what their current status is, because they're being asked to decide a criminal matter. Whereas in a commitment proceeding like this one, my recollection of the doctor's reports were they were full of references to different issues in a confined setting and acting out in that setting, and in fact being moved to a different setting. So, I mean, there would be ample evidence before the jury, I think.
I think there would, I would agree that I think it would have been presented to the jury that the individual had been in prison.
But I mean, in a criminal case, you would put up, you know, the things on the table. You would make sure they've got civilian clothing. The jury wouldn't see them in shackles. You would do a variety of things to keep from the jury the current status of the defendant. But this trial is full of information about the current
and I'm not sure
residency of the defendant or the committee.
I'm not sure that,
right?
That wasn't a bad strategy. I mean, I guess I'm not going to put myself in Attorney Morone's head at this point in time, but that might not have been a bad strategy. There are a couple of fact situations. Again, the stun, there were no shackles on him when the jury came in. The stun belt thing or whatever they put on their leg is well up on his thigh. That was totally invisible. Nobody could see it. Nobody could see any mechanism that would operate it. He was not accompanied, by the way, to the witness stand by a DOC guard. He was accompanied to the witness stand by a PCT, a psychiatric care technician, and that is in the record. They wear a polo shirt and black pants. So he was accompanied, but it wasn't a uniformed guard. There was a DOC guard in the room, and they wear their typical, I'm sure you've seen them, the blue shirt type thing with the emblem. So they were sitting in the back. Again, this man, I know his maximum discharge date is like 2036, so he's in prison for a while. I don't know how he could have been in a courtroom unless somebody's watching over him. So there was a single DOC guard there along with a PCT.
Counsel, Ms. Ball suggests that perhaps the evidence could have been presented in such a way that it would not suggest that he was incarcerated. And as I look through that part of the argument, I'm wondering if you modified that information enough to mask the fact that he's incarcerated, do you lose significant information that the jury needs to know?
I think as far as the information that Justice Ziegler was talking about all of the references to he wanted to put into his DOC records that he was Jesus. Okay, I don't know how we're going to shield that from the jury without literally not having testimony that should be coming in that they actually should hear.
But that goes to, I want to be respectful. That doesn't necessarily mean that because you think you are Jesus that you're dangerous to yourself or others.
I totally
Dangerousness is really the focus here in large part as I see it.
I was just answering Justice Kelly's question as to whether or not we'd be able to get all of the testimony. And I agree the focus here is on dangerousness, but I don't know how we would have kept out the fact that he was actually in prison. If you look at my questioning and the stuff that, I mean, I didn't even ask JM how many times he'd been convicted of a crime. I mean, I'm allowed to do that, but I don't do that. There was no intention to try to highlight the fact that he was in prison. In fact, I think that's to his advantage, personally. And again, I know that Ms. Ball does not agree with that, and perhaps none of you do, but to me, I think that is actually to his advantage to defeat mental commitment.
On the issue of dangerousness, for a person to be in prison, as a matter of law, a court has to consider the severity of the offense and the protection of the public. Why do you protect the public unless the person is arguably a reason to protect the public is to protect the public from some kind of danger, whether it be to property or person, right? So by the very fact that someone is imprisoned, I think there is a correlation that the public needs to be protected from you. The old adage that a picture says 1,000 words, and this is what your opposing counsel was saying earlier, referencing, I think, the Seventh Circuit case, that it's different saying it once, and yet if a picture says 1,000 words, a complete and continuous display must increase that number many, many times, and that's the constant communication. So it seems to me they're communicating dangerousness. And why isn't that prejudicial?
Well, Let me just, this was an extension proceeding, so I need to back up just a little bit so that you can understand. At an extension proceeding, I'm not attempting to prove any overt dangerousness. You can, if you read the transcript, you will see in both my opening and in my closing argument, I'm basically telling the jury, ignore the fact that he had these glares at the doctor, ignore that they felt threatened. Because that's not the standard I'm asking you to find.
No, you are asserting in the extension hearing that he continues to be a proper subject for commitment, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And a proper subject for commitment requires that there be a mental illness and that he be dangerous to himself or others. What are you trying to prove at the
standard,
extension hearing?
Your Honor, the standard under 5120 sub 1 sub AM, which what I consider to be the exception to dangerousness, is that based upon the individual's treatment record, that they will become a proper subject for commitment if treatment is withdrawn. That is the exception for dangerousness. There was no attempt to prove that this man sitting there that day was dangerous. What I was proving was that the doctor said that when they evaluated him, he wasn't going to comply with treatment, and that eventually he would discontinue treatment and his illness would again become more severe and he likely would become dangerous. This is the intent, but they didn't say that. And when J.M. got on the witness stand, he said he confirmed it. He said, yep, I'm not mentally ill and I'm not going to follow through with treatment. So that's what I had to prove, that based upon his treatment record, if treatment were currently withdrawn, he would become a proper subject for commitment. That is the exception to dangerousness. So I understand. So the question in the verdict is he dangerous? But the answer to that is yes, if, based upon his treatment record, treatment were withdrawn, he'd become a proper subject for commitment.
Mr. Carney, I recall from the briefing that the presiding judge made several references when instructing the jury about assessing credibility of witnesses, about appearance, and you can appearance of the witness. Now that has a certain resonance, of course. In this instance, I don't recall off the top of my head what, if anything, the presiding judge told the jury in this instance about the fact that J.M. was wearing penal garb.
She said nothing about that. I mean, she didn't. It was not brought up in any remarks that I recall that she made. She did read the standard jury instructions, which have the standard language in there about appearance. It wasn't highlighting appearance, and I think I tried to address that in my brief, but.
Does the record disclose? I recall from the briefing that the record seems to disclose that there was some discussion at the beginning of the trial, probably before the jury was brought in, that counsel for JM had attempted to locate and procure civilian clothing. And that those efforts were unsuccessful, but
I don't recall if that was actually in the record. I know that was in the motion for certain, Your Honor.
Okay.
But I'm not sure that was in the record. And my recollection is there was no objection by JM being in his prison garb. And I know that's the focal point here, but just to put a little more meaning to that, we took a break before J.M. had to make a decision to testify. The judge wanted to give his counsel an opportunity to make sure that he knew what he wanted to do there. And they had their discussion, and we came back on the record. The first thing the judge asked, of course, was, does J.M. want to testify? And the counsel said, yes, he does. And, of course, the judge assumed he would want to testify from defense counsel, so he would not have to get up and walk in front of the jury. That particular courtroom is set up where the witness stand is where Judge Kelly is, and the first juror is sitting where that young man is right there. So it's about two steps to the jury's in that particular courtroom. They're not all set up that way, but that one is the case. J.M. insisted on not testifying at the table, and he insisted on walking to the jury box after the jury was in the room. We would have allowed him to stay at the table. We would have allowed him to get into the jury box before the jury came in, but that was not his decision.
Okay, I was just going by my recollection of the briefing, but you were there. Your recollection of what the record, and you, not asking you to disclose anything that's not in the record, but the record does not disclose. I'm saying it as if I'm certain. I'm not. It's actually going to be followed by a question. Does the record disclose anything about any kind of discussion?
I do not believe it does.
Well, the motion for new trial in the record does indicate that counsel called the Wisconsin Resource Center about getting civilian clothes, but it wasn't resolved before the trial.
Well, resolved is different from even bringing the topic up.
Correct.
Okay.
I'm not even sure where the appellate attorney got that information that he put into the motion. I would have
but it's at least in that.
Resolved indicates that the topic was brought up, but it was left inconclusive, which was my impression until you started addressing the topic about 8 minutes ago.
He, again, there was no objection to him appearing in the prison garb. Until the motion, I would have had no information to even think that he...
Well, as a former circuit court judge, I wondered how a conversation like that could sort of fizzle out without someone insisting on a resolution to it, so that's why it caught my eye. Thank you.
Here. And, of course, J.M. could have arranged his own clothing as well. I mean, again, and that's... I'm not saying that the court can't consider defense counsel not helping to arrange for that as being deficient, but... Again, these are civil proceedings, and he could have. There are other means of which he could have obtained clothing if he wanted the clothing. And I put that big if in there because there is nothing in this record that even suggests at the time that this trial started that James was objecting to appearing in prison garb. He was directing his trial.
The counsel did ask for civilian clothes, as I understand it. They didn't appear, and that was the end of that.
That's in the motion, Your Honor, I believe. I believe that Justice Zeger has pointed that out.
I'm looking at the record, and there's the order denying post-conviction motion. It's in the record. At document 16 is the motion. It's not quite that, but you can take a look.
Well, there was a motion before trial, too.
The only motion I recall before trial was to remove the shackles, which I had already consented to, and it was I who had told the WRC officers to bring the other belt with them.
No, I think that's part of the argument. He was ineffective for not following up, getting it done, asking the court to provide it, providing it himself, getting it from WRC, or asking for a curative jury instruction. I think that's the argument.
I understand that. And from my experience, I would be very cautious of finding that ineffective. I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Members of the court, I'd like to start by saying that I'm at a complete disadvantage here. I was not in the courtroom when this trial occurred, and my opposing counsel has provided the members of this court with a fair amount of information that is not in the record, and I just want to remind the members of the court of that I was limited to the record, and the court's decision in this case should
likely be limited. What exactly are you talking about? What kind of information? Just tick it off.
I don't know how much of it I could, but even just the last exchange that came up about J.M. was directing the trial. That's news to me. That's not in the record. The PCTs, that those were not the transport officers we see mentioned in the transcript, or they weren't the DOC guards that opposing counsel conceded were there, where they were sitting, what they were wearing, that's the kind of information that none of that is in the trial transcript, which frankly isn't that long. So if you read it, you'll see that my characterizations in my brief are consistent with what I read, but I've heard a lot of new information here today, and I wanted to draw that to the court's attention.
Counsel, Mr. Kearney suggests that the fact that he was an inmate would have inevitably come out. There was no way of preventing that occurring. And he points specifically to the fact that J.M. wanted his Department of Corrections records updated to reflect his status as being Jesus Christ. And so certainly the fact that he was an inmate would have come out.
I think it is possible to edit the evidence here to refer to him maybe as a patient or in some other custodial status. I don't think it necessarily had to be an inmate. The reference to him claiming that he is Jesus, that's going to come in because it goes to mental illness. It goes to the issue of delusion, but it doesn't go to dangerousness, and that's what we're talking about here. The fact that a person thinks they're Jesus or somebody else, you can walk down State Street any day of the week and hear someone saying that. It doesn't mean they're mentally ill and dangerous, which are the two things the Constitution requires for a commitment.
Right. So in this context, though, if you are, doesn't have some independent significance that a person is saying, you know what, I want the Department of Corrections to know that I'm Jesus, right? As opposed to some guy just walking down the street and telling a passerby that that's who he is. Doesn't that have some independent significance that that the county should be able to present to the jury?
I have to say I haven't ever thought of it before as that being the point. I'm not so worried about the reference to the DOC as the fact that he's mm-hmm. dressed in prison clothes. And,
right.
and that's what Estelle is all about. That's what Mouse v. Baker is about. I mean, Estelle says the defendant's clothing is so likely to be a continuing influence throughout the trial that not unlike placing the jury in the custody of deputy sheriffs who are also witnesses for the prosecution, an unacceptable risk is presented of impermissible factors coming into play. That's what this case is about. It's about the visual above all, Your Honor.
And that's a United States Supreme Court decision.
Yes, that is Estelle v. Williams. And
as a practical matter, though, isn't it difficult to instruct all of the witnesses, including in this case JM, to not refer to his imprisonment or anything like that? As a practical matter, isn't it difficult to, I mean, you can tell the witnesses that, but when they start testifying and telling their story, that instruction basically tells them to kind of excise some of the truth. And so wouldn't it be a reasonable strategic decision for his counsel to say, you know, I think this is probably going to come out one way or another, no matter what our efforts to hide the fact of his imprisonment. So I'm just going to bring it out and make sure that I don't have any jurors on this jury who would be prejudiced because of his prison status.
Okay, well, let's assume that's true. That still doesn't mean he should be sitting there in a prison uniform. Also, counsel could have requested, and this is in the post-conviction motion, some sort of curative instruction saying we're going to be discussing the fact that this person is a prisoner and here's what we want you, jury, to do or not do. So there were a lot of different types of deficient performance in this case, is my point. It's not sufficient to seize on one and say, well, it's impossible to edit out, you know, any reference to it when the person's still sitting there in prison. Right? So I guess that's my argument. And I want to get back to that point because opposing counsel says, you know, up in Winnebago County, prisoners are tried in prison clothes all the time. Okay? And that should give this court some concern. As the quote I just read to you from Estelle says, this is very serious, and this is a reason we want ineffective assistance of counsel claims. Things happen in these cases that no one sees because of the short timeline, because the prejudice prong doesn't work here. You want to be able to look at these cases and tell the bar, to tell the lawyers that are defending these clients, this is what deficient performance looks like under Chapter 51 when you're working in compressed deadlines. We don't have that body of case law right now.
Good. Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for a very, very interesting case, for excellent briefs and very fine oral arguments. We are going to adjourn now, and the court will meet in closed conference at 3:10. Thank you.